This is Lisa Miller & Associates, Florida Insurance Roundup, your podcast on the people, issues, and regulations shaping Florida's insurance market. Now, here's Lisa Miller.
Welcome, friends. On September 14, 2018, Hurricane Florence struck the Carolinas. This historic storm was a record setter in rainfall, we all know it, with some in North Carolina receiving 3 feet of rain. Statewide damage estimates are nearly $13 billion, with estimated insured losses, those where people can file insurance claims, much less at $3 to $5 billion. Most homeowners' insurance policies don't cover flood damage, and those who had flood insurance were in the clear minority. 64% of North Carolina residents in flood risk zones had no federal flood insurance. Almost 40% of South Carolinians similarly had no flood coverage. Many have heard me say that floodwaters don't know to stop flowing just because a FEMA or other map says they won't. Floodwaters have a mind of their own, in my opinion, as evidenced by what we saw. Coming on the heels of Hurricane Harvey's flood devastation last year in Houston, Texas, what will this hurricane teach us this time around? How can we better protect our lives and property from floodwaters, and what urgency will Florence bring on providing better flood insurance protection for coastal and inland U.S. residents alike? For those of us here in Florida, we wonder what our state would have looked like if Hurricane Florence had hit here. And now, 15 months after Hurricane Irma struck Florida, another question. Which mitigation and resiliency programs underway here since then promise to best reduce future flood losses and save money? This is a big program for us today. I'm very excited to have these tremendous guests joining us. We'll tackle these questions with Dr. Robert Young, Professor of Coastal Geology and Director of the Program for the Study of Developed Shorelines at Western Carolina University in Cullowhee, North Carolina, and Dr. Roger Grenier, Senior Vice President and Global Resilience Practice Leader at AIR Worldwide in Boston. AIR is an international risk modeling and data analytics firm specializing in catastrophes. I'd like for each of our guests today, it's kind of a little different than what we've done before, to tell us, as I like to say, how they spend their days, because the work they are doing is so vitally important to resiliency and flood coverage insurance, other topics throughout the world. Roger, let's start with you. Tell us what you do and how you do it and why you love doing it.
Well, hi, Lisa, and thank you for having me. As you mentioned, AIR develops catastrophe risk models. And these models have traditionally been used by the insurance and reinsurance industry to estimate the risk of extreme events. They really started following Hurricane Andrew. Prior to Hurricane Andrew, there was very little information about the potential size of an extreme event in terms of the losses that they could produce. If we fast forward the almost 30 years since Hurricane Andrew to last year, as you mentioned, with a significant number of events, the insurance and reinsurance industries actually have been able to weather those events quite well. And that's largely because of the data and analytics they receive from companies like ours. So in the resiliency practice, our goal is to really help provide the same level of resilience to communities using the models that have proven to be very helpful in making the insurance and reinsurance industry so resilient over time.
That's incredible. And I have followed your work and AIR's work over many years and watched these models help a lot of insurance companies, communities, and others figure out what's in their future, if I can say it that way. Rob, how about you? I know I heard when I listened to you on National Public Radio and was, you know, just astonished at what you've done, and you are all over the world. Tell us how you spend your days and why you do it and why you love it.
I direct a center called the Program for the Study of Developed Shorelines, and we're somewhat unique in that we have both sort of scientists and policy wonks under the same roof. So we do on-the-ground coastal science, looking at how storms and long-term sea level rise change the coast, and we also take that science that we're doing and the science that others are doing, and we try to communicate it to decision-makers at all levels. So we work with individual property owners who are struggling with issues of storm damage reduction or coastal hazards, to the property owners association level and municipalities who are trying to understand how they might implement a coastal protection project, to a much larger level where we've developed tools for the Department of Interior to assess coastal vulnerability at the building-by-building, road-by-road level so that you may develop detailed adaptation plans from that assessment. So the work that we do is very much at ground level, and you know, I really enjoy the kind of science that is not quite so ivory tower, but very applied. We like to do coastal science that makes a difference.
Incredible work. And I think between you and Roger, doing the real work is what matters. So Roger, I'm going to start with you. You know, there's discussion in the marketplace now about, you know, can you predict the future? What is climate change about to do to us? There's discussion about scrapping the maps that FEMA uses to help us all determine risk, and moving to these catastrophe models. Can you tell us why I think maybe the two of them could cohabitate, or how that would work?
You know, the NFIP, the National Flood Insurance Program, which is really sort of what is developed the maps, that just celebrated its 50th anniversary this year. And over time, the mapping technology that's been used has really evolved. And I think what we'll see going into the future is a wider adoption of models such as the catastrophe models that we develop to help assess the risk. And I think there will be a couple of key benefits associated with those. The first is that, as you mentioned, we really need to be looking forward when it comes to assessing the risk. In a large part, the maps that are out there today are based on kind of a historical view. So looking at the historical stream flows, the historical hazard areas that have been developed based on the current land use and so on, and land use over time. When you develop a model, you can look forward and assess not only changes in land use, but also changes in the climate. And that's how our models are driven, is by starting really with a climate model as opposed to just strictly relying on historical data. Another benefit is that the cost and the scalability of being able to leverage technology in the way that we've done is a tremendous advantage. So we're able to build a model at continental scale that can be updated more frequently than the current approach, which really requires effectively boots on the ground, if you will. And finally, the last thing to point out is that the current maps sort of have this sort of binary view of risk. You're either inside of a flood zone or outside of a flood zone in the way that it's presented. And really, that's not the reality. The reality is that there's a spectrum of hazard and loss potential, and that's what the models really allow us to identify, not just on the floodplains, but also off the floodplains where flash flooding and other things can occur.
Wonderful work, Roger. That's very helpful. So, Rob, throwing it over to you, I laugh when I've heard that old saying that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. And I know post-storms, you put on your boots and you get out in the middle of those, and you've seen what the cycle, you know, of Mother Nature does to us as she whips us around, and then we have to rebuild, and then we whip around and rebuild. How do you see us stopping that cycle? Do you see some of Roger's work? I'm sure you're familiar with all the catastrophe models. And what do you wish when you're in the field after a catastrophe would have happened or should have happened or could happen?
Well, in my opinion, the biggest problem we have at the moment is that we have far more incentive to do the wrong thing than we have to do the right thing. So following a storm like Sandy or Harvey or pick a storm, Katrina or even Florence, we spend a lot of money putting folks right back where they were, and maybe we take an adaptation action like raising properties. Again, I'm speaking primarily in my experience of the coastal zone, so I'm not talking about flooding in the Mississippi River Basin or something like that. That's a little bit out of my area of expertise. But following Sandy in New Jersey, we lifted a lot of homes up, but there's, you know, that's only a partial solution. If you lift up an oceanfront home, you still have to hold the shoreline in place. And if you raise a community anywhere in the floodplain, you still have to get utilities to that community, and you have to get transportation in there. And so the biggest problem that I see right now is that there are very few incentives to change the exposure map for these communities. In other words, to get some properties out of areas that are in the floodplain. We do have a little bit of incentive to elevate, and that comes primarily from the National Flood Insurance Program, but there are a lot of incentives for people to rebuild. Look at Dauphin Island, Alabama. They've received federal disaster declarations 7 times in the last 25, 30 years, and there have been properties that have been rebuilt multiple times in the same location, and they keep rebuilding. And you might say, well, guys, those people must be crazy on Dauphin Island to continue to rebuild. And the fact of the matter is they're not. They're making a perfectly rational economic decision. They have federal and state subsidies that put that infrastructure back and that make it for them to continue to rebuild their homes because they're still making money. So it's not the folks on Dauphin Island that are crazy. It's the rest of us that are crazy for allowing that to happen. So, you know, the secret in my mind is ultimately to sort of change this structure that incentivizes especially investment property on Barrier Island resort communities. We need to find a way for the true costs of living in these dangerous places to be incorporated into the value of those properties and the cost of living in dangerous locations. But we need to do it in a thoughtful way because there are also working class communities in flood zones and in our coastal zones, people living in their primary residences. And I would always imagine that the strategies we would have for helping those folks would be very different from the strategies we might have on the oceanfront and trying to make sure that people on that oceanfront are paying their own freight for the level of protection that they get.
So let me throw something at the both of you. The White House budget this year, as you probably know, reiterated the reforms that would, quote, ensure the continued financial stability of the NFIP while maintaining affordability for low-income policyholders and expand the private insurance market to get the federal government out of the flood insurance business. And that came from Budget Director Mick Mulvaney. And under his proposal, FEMA would have the authority to discontinue NFIP coverage, national federal flood insurance coverage for extreme repetitive loss properties following future losses, and may even exclude coverage for other risks, depending on how strong he decides to come out and talk about it. But starting in 2021, the program would phase out coverage for commercial properties altogether, and no policies could be written for new construction inside a special flood hazard area. I mean, I think that's bold, but I'm going to throw it to you, Roger. Where do you think it's going to go? Do you think it's too drastic? Do you think it can happen?
Well, I think it will be a process. I guess we'll start there. It is kind of a bold way forward, but as Rob was mentioning, there's a lot of incentives to people building in harm's way or people staying in harm's way. And I think part of the fallout of the changes that we'd see if the federal government were to get out of that flood insurance business is that you'll see more actuarially sound rates forming the flood insurance that people are paying. And that will send a fairly strong market signal. So it could put some potential damper, I guess, if you will, on coastal development. I suspect what we'd see is that in the short term and maybe medium term, the private insurance market will continue to evolve. And using models like ours, they're starting to get to the point where they can, well, they're at the point really now where they can evaluate the risk and understand how it affects their portfolios and adequately price for it and reserve for it and all those things. I think prices in the private market are very competitive in sort of the lower risk areas. I think where the challenge will be is in the very highest risk areas where the current NFIP rates, insurance rates are really much lower than what most actuaries would say are required. So one potential way this will evolve is that the federal government will sort of evolve into being a high risk pool where the very highest risk policies are in this pool. And the private market is absorbing the rest of the risk. So I think it'll be a process, but I think there certainly change needs to be made. The NFIP is probably $20 billion in debt. And that was, you know, after forgiving $16 billion last year, and we haven't talked about this year's event. So certainly change is required, and bold change at that.
So, Rob, I'll throw that question to you and also want to have you comment on supposing that NFIP does discontinue this coverage in this orderly fashion. Is there a way you think we could tag structures or label structures that would indicate this hard choice that would preclude folks? I mean, through a scientific way of doing it, have you ever thought about that? And what do you think about the White House proposal, Rob?
So, you know, there have been proposals to reform the National Flood Insurance Program that have cropped up for the last 30 years. And I'm really skeptical that some of those difficult and bold reforms will happen, especially in the completely dysfunctional atmosphere that exists in Washington, D.C. these days. So, you know, it's nice to talk about things like that, but you know, every time we try to reform the flood insurance program, there's a revolt from coastal legislators on both parties, and it just proves to be very, very difficult. The other issue is that, you know, it's not just the National Flood Insurance Program that's the problem. Public assistance offered under the Stafford Act is another huge part of the problem. I mean, this is where we get these $60 billion relief bills, and even more than that after Harvey and Irma, where money pours into communities from a variety of different agencies and in a variety of different ways and puts the infrastructure back and provides loans and small business loans. And the Corps of Engineers got $6 billion after Sandy, more than $15 billion after Harvey and Irma to do coastal protection projects. These are all ways that we're using public funds to subsidize risk and to try and help communities maintain the value of their tax base using public funds that, combined with the Federal Flood Insurance Program, you know, as I said earlier, really incentivize, create a moral hazard for how we develop in hazardous areas. So the reform, if you really want to sort of change the exposure and vulnerability footprint in areas that are exposed to flooding, the reforms that we need are much greater than just National Flood Insurance Program reforms. It's a lot to ask for, and I keep thinking as we have these bigger and bigger storms and the price tag just keeps going up and up and up, that eventually the fiscal conservatives in Congress are going to scream enough, and we're really going to get serious about how we deal with these issues. The supplemental spending bill that was passed after Sandy and the spending bill that passed this last February for Harvey and Irma, the price tag just continues to climb, and nobody seems to be batting an eyebrow. So, you know, I'm not sure what the expenditures would have to be in order for us to really take a seriously hard look at how we're spending money in these hazard-prone areas.
So in winding this up, I think one idea that we could talk about is the concept of letting states take things in their own hands. I've been on a speaking circuit and seen you on the trail talking about how states can step up and put in a framework for private flood insurance. And I think that is where we will head, and we'll probably save that for a future podcast. But I think within our own states, Massachusetts for you, Roger, and North Carolina for you, Rob, I'll be in touch with you. We can go sit with our respective state elected officials and see how we can't push hard for the private flood insurance market, because you're right, Rob. We just can't keep doing the same thing over and over and again and expecting a different result. So your comments have been very on point, and I just want to thank you both for caring about what you do, giving a darn, as we say in the South, because after these storms and before the storms, you are evangelist in my eyes and carrying the good news of what the way we can do things differently and better for our future. So thank you so much for being on the show, Rob.
My pleasure.
And Roger, you as well. Keep up the great work. I know it's freezing in Massachusetts, and I just watch you as you travel and traverse the world.
Thank you.
So in property insurance, there's three major drivers of loss: what we build, how we build, and where we build. It's clear as crystal that when it comes to flood risk, we still build too close to known dangers. And you know, Rob, you've been preaching that. Roger, you as well. We call this podcast Flood Follies because of the growing folly of our public policy that keeps encouraging this risky human behavior. And we all pay for it, some with our own checkbook, others through higher taxpayer subsidies, and yet others, sadly, who die in these terrible storms because they've built in risky areas. Federal flood insurance has encouraged homeowners to disregard risk by providing those subsidized premiums at a level what it should be to cover the cost of those claims. Even more perverse is we are paying homeowners to rebuild these flooded homes in the same spots over and over again. And I hope that becomes a focus with the repetitive loss property discussions that we're seeing in the news recently. The good news? FEMA's redesigning its 2019 rates to more realistically price risk, and private insurance companies powered by advanced catastrophe risk models that Roger works every day with are better able to understand this risk and price it. So we can accurately look at flood risk, what the premium should be, down to the individual properties, and giving greater consumer choice and alternatives to a federal insurance program. And we know here in Florida that when state government encourages it, a vibrant, competitive insurance market can emerge. In just 3 years, in Florida, almost 30 companies are offering better and less expensive flood insurance coverage as alternatives to the National Flood Insurance Program. And I am proud to have been a part of that with our great Senator Jeff Brandis, who put that law on the books. And it is our hope that we can encourage the other 49 states to follow suit. So with that, I want to hear from you. You can call us and leave me a comment or question for our later reply on air right here on the Florida Insurance Roundup. The number is 850-388-8002. That's 850-388-8002. Or drop me an email, lisamiller@lisamillerassociates.com. I answer them personally. That's it for the Florida Insurance Roundup. Thank you for being a part of it. Remember, at Lisa Miller & Associates, we have a passion for policy and client success. I'm Lisa Miller. Until next time, be safe.
This has been Lisa Miller & Associates' Florida Insurance Roundup, your podcast on the people, issues, and regulations shaping Florida's insurance market. For more information on today's program, please visit us on the web at www.lisamillerassociates.com.